This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. You've probably heard that the Supreme Court is set to rule sometime soon on an important case about affirmative action in higher education. We decided we wanted to find out more about the young woman whose name is on the case, Abigail Fisher. That's coming up later in the program. But first, we want to go back to a story that commanded so much of our attention last year, the shooting at a school in Newtown, Connecticut. It was a little over 6 months ago, and it was a day that at the time seemed like a game changer. Even President Obama, known for his cool, could not hold back the tears when he spoke to the country about it. Since then, though, the debate on Capitol Hill has moved to immigration. A plan to strengthen background checks for gun buyers and limit magazine capacities failed in the Senate back in April. And this time, when President Obama spoke to the country, he seemed angry.
If action by Congress could have saved one person, one child, a few hundred, a few thousand, if it could have prevented those people from losing their lives to gun violence in the future while preserving our Second Amendment rights, we had an obligation to try.
But that got us wondering what some of the survivors of past gun violence and how they're reacting to the seeming stalemate. So we've called upon Colin Goddard. He's a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. Now he's decided to work full time on the issue as an activist. He's campaigns manager at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. And he was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Colin, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Before we get to the politics of the debate right now, I did want to ask about you, if you're okay. You were shot four times at the shooting at Virginia Tech years ago, and I just wondered if you still think about it.
Yeah, to start with physically, I'm okay. I have a soccer game tonight in D.C. to play. I'm looking forward to. Mentally, it's been much more of a roller coaster, I'd say. There are some good days, there are some bad days. You know, kind of the nature of the experience that you have with gun violence, you know, is often very, very sudden, very immediate, and very traumatic, so you don't kind of process the memories of it normally, and you store it in random places. So there can be random things that kind of make you recall very traumatic experience. And, you know, like I said, ups and downs, a smell, a sight, I mean, movies, I mean, you know, songs, even conversations. People say, oh, you know, God, I just want to shoot myself. And then they look at me, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to say that. And it's like, you know, I understand there's, you know, figure of speech, but little things like that. But overall, you know, I found a way, you know, learning what I did about gun policy in this country and our current state, I found a way where I can take the negative experience that I had and try to put it towards something positive and make it a change that will help prevent other people from falling in the same situation I was in.
I was going to ask you about that, how it is that you decided to become an activist in this area, at least for this part of your life. I'm sure a lot of people would certainly understand if you decided to kind of finish your physical therapy and just move on and try not to think about it again. But by definition now, because you're working in this area, you have to think about it. I wondered, what was the, was there like a eureka moment when you just, it clicked in for you that this is something you're going to have to do right now?
Well, I had my kind of Newtown moment in April 3rd of 2009, the shooting at the Binghamton, New York Immigration Center was about 2 years after the shooting that I was involved with. And in those, during those 2 years, I had not watched the news of other shootings. I mean, there was Northern Illinois in 2008. And I heard about these things. I just couldn't bring myself to watch it. And just how I naturally turned on the TV that morning when the Binghamton news story broke, I sat there in front of the television and couldn't turn away and was flooded with all the same emotions that I had from day one of getting shot. And now, and I had gotten to a good place, physical therapy with my family, you know, 2 years later, and now I saw another group of 13 families on day one going through everything that I had been through. And by that point, my parents had naturally asked this question after their, you know, send their kid to college and gets hurt, like, how did this happen? Why did this happen to my kid? That's a natural, you know, pursuit I think most parents would make. And in that pursuit, they learned about school policies, they learned about mental health, and they learned about the gun policies. And they educated me as to what they were learning, going through everything that they did through the Virginia Tech review panel to the lawsuits to things like that. And, you know, what I learned that, you know, we don't even do a background check on every gun sale in this country was just so fundamentally wrong, in my opinion, that the kind of bucket, the drop that tipped the bucket over was Binghamton. And ever since that day, I've been working on this issue full-time, sharing my story full-time, and with the goal of you know, making sure we pass legislation to require a background check on every gun sale.
As you mentioned, the big push in policy for people on your side of the question seems to be for universal background checks. Why is that the priority?
For a number of reasons. I mean, background checks, I think, first of all, most people think we already do them on every sale, and I'm kind of shocked to learn that we don't. I think there's the biggest kind of public support of it already. I mean, we haven't seen a poll with less than 90% of Americans supporting this policy. However you break it down, from men to women to gun owners to left-handed people to whatever, it's understood to be good policy. You know, it just makes responsible sense to know that the person who's about to buy a gun can legally do so. And the only reason to really do that is to do a background check. And I think there's also the biggest amount of political will. I mean, despite the bad headlines, you know, last month in April out of the Senate, we had a majority of U.S. senators vote in support of expanding background checks. We had six NRA A-rated members vote in support of background checks. Today, we have 182 co-sponsors of the background check bill in the House. I mean, more than I've ever seen since I started working on this. So, you know, despite the fact that, you know, that maybe the three major media TV outlets aren't talking about this on a daily basis like they were before, you know, I am busier now than I ever have been at this job. And there are so many more people now trying to get involved and wanting to help out and make their voices heard. So it's just a matter of getting to all those people, engaging them in a positive way and making their voices heard directly to their elected members.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the gun control or gun safety movement. We're speaking with Colin Goddard. He is campaigns manager for the Brady campaign. He's a survivor of the 2007 shooting at Virginia Tech, where he was shot four times. When the legislation failed in the Senate in April, as it has so many times before, did you feel discouraged? And how do you feel now?
That was a tough day, for sure. You can't lie about that. That was really tough. I knew kind of a day before that the vote was going to be really close. You know, I thought people in the Senate would vote their conscience, vote, you know, on behalf of their law enforcement officials, you know, vote on behalf of their constituents, not on the behalf of an industry. And it was disappointing. You know, there was a lot of victims and survivors of gun violence in the gallery watching the vote go down that morning. And one of them was Sarah Brady. And she immediately turned to a lot of the folks who had just got up and had this very just lost look on their face. And she said, when we tried to pass the Brady bill, which set up this background check system, it took six major floor votes. It took, you know, three different Congresses and three different presidential administrations. She's like, sometimes a good loss will do you some good. And I've heard so many times since Virginia Tech, you know, if this shooting isn't the one that changes things or causes something to be done differently, I don't know what is. And I don't think there's a number of people or children that are going to get killed in one single incident that will do that. I think the tragedy that the American people needed to see was when a minority of politicians blocked the will of the majority, as they did in the Senate in April. And that was what woke a lot of people up, got a lot of people upset with this whole process, and ultimately got a lot of more people engaged on this issue. And as a result, I think has strengthened our movement, strengthened our resolve, strengthened our numbers to get to the point where, you know, we will continue to do this. We aren't going away. We've changed the public understanding of this issue, and like I said, 90% of people support it. Now we just have to clean up the politics.
But what about the fact, though, when you ask people to rate the issues that matter to them? I mean, one of the arguments that people make is, well, there are two arguments that people make on the other side. One argument that they make on the other side is they just don't agree with you that that's the right issue. They argue that it's something cultural, that it's something cultural about this country's relationship to violence. They argue it's really a broken mental health system that's really the issue. But other people say that the intensity is on the other side, that people who prefer the status quo and they don't want restrictions on gun ownership and all these other things. They have the intensity around the issue, and everybody else may agree with you philosophically, but they're not prepared to give it the hierarchy that the other side is. I mean, what do you say to that?
Well, I do acknowledge that the intensity has been predominantly on the, quote, other side, so to speak. But, you know, our intensity is matching that. I mean, this is not like a light switch to flip. This is like a battleship to turn that takes over time. I mean, when we saw the vote fail in the Senate, and then we saw senators who voted against it lose 15% point approval rating overnight. I mean, that was what we hadn't seen on this issue in decades. I mean, we didn't even had a vote in the Senate in over two decades. And the only reason we had this vote was because the American people stood up and demanded it. And we wanted to know, you know, why what people think about background checks. Why are you opposed to expanding background checks? You know, we deserve a vote was the refrain the president used that we took all the way through and ultimately got us that vote. You know, the intensity is being matched now, and this is like a long term thing. Like I said, not something that happens overnight. But there are a lot of issues, and you know, we acknowledge that. You know, it was a setback in the Senate, but you know, we're still putting a lot of pressure on switching those five members. We're now looking at the House as well to make progress there, as well as in state legislatures across the country. A lot of states have done good things.
You seem like a happy guy. I mean, you know what I mean? You mentioned that, you know, you're doing well physically and stuff like that. What's keeping you going? I mean, as you mentioned, this could be very discouraging for a lot of people. What's keeping you going? As briefly as you can, if you would.
Well, as much as when you hear a breaking news story, you just kind of want to crawl up into a ball and not talk to anybody about it. You know, because you're going being re-traumatized yourself. Ultimately, it strengthens your resolve because you understand that this is an issue that is literally life and death, and making solutions, finding solutions to this issue, common sense solutions, are going to save lives. And I know that this is good public policy. I know this is the right thing to do, and I know that we have changed the paradigm from if something will be done about background checks to when. I mean, it really is just a matter of time before the politicians catch up with the general American public.
That was Colin Goddard. He is a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. He's now serving as campaigns manager at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, and he's kind enough to join us on our Washington, D.C. studios. Colin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're still waiting for the Supreme Court's affirmative action ruling, so we'll take a look at the young woman at the center of the case and the man behind her challenge.
He wanted to find white applicants who were pretty good students, but whose grades just fell below that top 10% cutoff.
That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As we mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court is expected to rule this month on some of this country's most divisive issues, including same-sex marriage and affirmative action. Later, we'll hear about a new film that takes a fresh look at attitudes about same-sex marriage among African Americans. There are some nuances there that might surprise those who thought they've heard it all. That's later. But first, we want to take a step back and talk more about the young woman at the center of the affirmative action case that's before the court. Her name is Abigail Fisher. Nicole Hannah-Jones, a staff writer for ProPublica, reported on the very interesting story of how Ms. Fisher came to be at the center of this case. We spoke with her earlier. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I think the first revelation for many people might be that big cases like this don't just happen by accident for the most part. That dating back to the NAACP's challenge of Jim Crow laws, that the group, this is reported in your story, carefully looked for people whose stories would, in your words, elicit both sympathy and outrage and whose lives could withstand public scrutiny. And you say that Abigail Fisher was essentially recruited in the same fashion.
Yes, that's right. Abigail Fisher was recruited by a man named Edward Bloom, and he runs a nonprofit called the Project for Fair Representation. And so he was looking for a plaintiff to challenge the use of race in affirmative action for admissions at the University of Texas at Austin.
And why was he so interested in the University of Texas at Austin?
University of Texas had had a top 10 program where the top 10% of any high school class in the state could get into the university automatically. And after a 2007 Supreme Court ruling, it reinstated affirmative action. And so he wanted to challenge that because he was saying that the university had been able to meet the goals of diversity without having to take race into account.
Well, also worth noting, he went to the University of Texas. And one thing that may have been attractive about Abigail Fisher is that her sister and her father also went there. Now, she hasn't spent a lot of time talking to the media, but there are a couple of videos posted on YouTube by this group that you told us about, the Project on Fair Representation. I'll just play a short clip from one of them. Here it is.
I was taught from the time I was a little girl that any kind of discrimination was wrong. And for an institution of higher learning to act this way makes no sense to me. What kind of example does this set for others?
Any idea how Edward Blum found her?
Well, he began to put a call out looking for plaintiffs. He wanted to find white applicants who were pretty good students, but whose grades just fell below that top 10% cutoff. And he actually was contacted by Abigail Fisher's father, who was an associate of Blum's, and he told him that his daughter had, in fact, been denied admissions and that he was willing to lend her name to the suit.
Any idea why? I know that you reached out to him. Why is he so interested in this?
Well, he's part of a group of conservatives who believe that the Constitution is colorblind and that programs like affirmative action or like the Voting Rights Act that actually look at a person's race, that those are discriminatory against white Americans and that they violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
We're speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's a staff writer for ProPublica. We are talking about a piece that she wrote called A Colorblind Constitution, What Abigail Fisher's Affirmative Action Case is Really About. She's looked into the background of Abigail Fisher and how she came to be the lead plaintiff in this case. So let's talk now about the substance of her argument. She says that she believes she was discriminated against based on race. She says that non-white people with lower grades and fewer activities got into the University of Texas, and she didn't. But you make the point in your piece that it is true that there were applicants with lower test scores and grades than Fisher, but only 5 of those were black or Latino, but 42 of those were white, and that these are not mentioned in her case at all. And you also say that there were 168 black or Latino students with grades as good or better than hers who were also denied admission to the university. So what's her argument?
This question was what initially got me interested in reporting this story. I'm always interested when people claim that they lost a job or they lost an opportunity to attend a school because an unqualified or underqualified minority took their place. I'm always interested in how does one know the qualifications of another student or another applicant. I didn't find that really answered in the reporting that I'd seen thus far, so I literally went to the court filings and found out that that actually was not really the argument that Abigail Fisher was making. I called Edward Blum and I spoke with him, and he admits that he really has no way of knowing whether or not race caused Abigail Fisher the spot, particularly since there were equally qualified black and Latino students who were also denied, and there were less qualified white students who were able to get into the school. But really the challenge is about whether or not University of Texas can use race at all. And his argument is just by considering race, that discriminated against white students, whether or not it ultimately affected their ability to gain admission into the school or not, that just by using race, that was a violation of the 14th Amendment.
Why does he feel that any consideration of race is somehow to the detriment of the fortunes and opportunities of white people and not the other way?
Well, it's very interesting. This kind of way of thinking really dates back to Southern resistance to the civil rights movement. The NAACP and other groups during the civil rights movement were arguing that the Constitution was colorblind, and so therefore legal segregation by law was unconstitutional. And so immediately after we started to see civil rights laws overturning the use of race to subordinate African Americans across the South, you began to see Southerners using that same argument to then resist the race-conscious remedies that were coming out of that, most specifically court orders to use race to desegregate schools. So it's picked up steam starting in the 70s, moving forward, where you had conservative groups then saying, well, the law says that you can't use race at all, and these programs that use race in order to help African Americans and Latinos are just as discriminatory as legalized segregation was.
I'm still kind of focusing on the fact that there were 42 white students with grades and resumes that were inferior to hers who were admitted to the University of Texas, and only 5 black or Latino students were. But somehow the argument remains that somehow blacks and Latinos were advantaged. And I'm still not getting how it is that this was argued. Did these facts even come up in the course of the oral argument?
I think it's perplexing to a lot of people who have closely followed the case. And when I've talked to scholars about this, what they say is the conservative justices on the Supreme Court have an interest in getting rid of these race-conscious programs. And so they were willing to overlook certain weaknesses in the case. So the fact that white students with lower grades may have gotten in and Black and Latino students with better grades did not get in really was irrelevant.
And what about the progressive or the not conservative justices, the moderate justices? Do they seem to have been interested in these facts?
Well, certainly some of them questioned whether the court should have even granted standing to this case in the first place. Abigail Fisher had already graduated from college by the time this case came up. She was working, so there was no ongoing harm. The only thing that she asked for in terms of damages was the return of her $100 application fee and housing deposit. And so there was a lot of concern about this case and the facts of the case by the more liberal justices.
Where did she wind up going to college, and what's she doing?
She ended up going to Louisiana State University, and she works in finance in Austin. And the only thing that she has said where she believes she was harmed by the University of Texas's decision not to admit her was that maybe she would have gotten a better first job when she graduated.
What reaction have you gotten to the piece?
This piece was very popular. It received somewhere around 500,000 clicks on various websites. I think people were really interested to hear the facts behind the case and to really understand that the assertions around race and what happened to Abigail Fisher weren't really true.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a staff writer for ProPublica. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
I do want to mention once again that we reached out to Mr. Edward Bloom shortly before the court decision was made, but he declined to comment or to speak with us. And now we turn to another college admission story. In 1961, Phyllis Richmond was a young writer and researcher who developed an interest in urban planning. After taking a couple of courses at one Ivy League school, she decided to try pursuing a graduate degree full-time at one of the country's most prestigious, Harvard, and she started the application. But before she could put the finishing touches on it, Richmond received a letter from one of the professors serving on the admissions committee. He said they liked her application, but he asked her to consider her, quote, responsibilities to her husband and a possible future family, unquote, and described to the committee how she planned to make it all work. Richmond says the letter so discouraged her she didn't bother to finish it or answer the letter. But 52 years later, after an award-winning career as a restaurant critic and writer, Richmond changed her mind, and she did pen a reply, and the Washington Post recently published it. And she's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios to tell us more about it. Phyllis Richmond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
When you started that application, did you think that there would be some resistance to you going to grad school full-time?
I didn't expect resistance from that, and I did worry about how I was going to do it, about how I was going to pay for it. It never occurred to me that I would be given less consideration because I was a woman. I knew women in the field, and I had grown up in a planned community in Greenbelt, Maryland, which was a project of Eleanor Roosevelt. Women and planning were very well connected in my head.
So when you got the letter, can you just describe for us, you know, all these years later, just what went through your mind? I mean, how did that feel?
I had forgotten that there was a letter, but I had had a talk with the man who wrote the letter, an interview with him, and he told me that his prime example was that his wife had a planning degree and she was home raising children. That didn't seem much of a deterrent to me. Children grow up. And it turns out that they had three children in 4 years. Of course, one of them would have to be raising these children. And she went on to have a what seemed to me an illustrious career in planning. But she certainly inadvertently played a role in my not going into planning.
The professor you're speaking about here was a Professor William Doble. Did he say that that his wife felt that her education was wasted or that
he felt it was wasted?
It wasn't just him. I mean, one of the things you wrote in your piece is your letter shows just how much Harvard, not to mention my husband, our families, and even myself, didn't give my career the respect it deserved when I was starting out. I mean, talk about that for a minute. I mean, was it really all Professor Doble being a jerk?
You know, why didn't I fight him on it? Well, it wouldn't have been in me to fight authority, for one thing. I accepted what he said, and I certainly didn't like it, and I didn't think it was fair, but it was what the world was like for me at that point.
What made you want to write this response all these years later? You mentioned you were going through a box of mementos and you came across the letter and you said even though you'd met with him, it occurred to you you'd never really responded to the letter. What made you want to do that now?
I have a daughter and I have a niece, two nieces, who look to me as a model for their behavior. I felt very proud, humbled by that. And so when I saw this letter, I thought, this is the kind of thing that she's talking about, that she's proud that I'm a model for her in standing up for my rights. So I thought, now is time to respond to this. I showed this letter to my daughter, my niece. They were appalled. They were horrified. And I was relieved that they were appalled. I didn't know whether women today took it for granted that they had a rightful place that was given to them when it was appropriate.
One of the things that you said in your letter, in your response, was that the arc of a career can be long, that it doesn't have to be that a woman pursues a career in the same way that a man does, that you can take breaks or divert from task and then return to the task. And you cite, again, Professor Doble's own wife, who did return to the academy, did return to the profession, and went on to have quite a distinguished career.
Well, women's careers, at least then and perhaps now, just take more circuitous routes. I was taking graduate courses for the time that I was raising children. I was working on a thesis, a master's degree. I started freelance writing. So at one time, I was raising three small children and writing and in school. You have to be flexible when you're trying to do this. And I was flexible enough that I found writing, that I recognized writing as the career that I really wanted at that point.
So your beef is not that the question is asked, but that it was only asked of women, that why weren't the men being asked, what do you plan to do with this?
Right,
how do
exactly,
you plan to make it
exactly.
work? Yeah, you did get a response, Professor Doble.
Yes.
Were you surprised that you got a response?
Well, actually, it was the post-editor's idea. I thought it was a great idea. I have been trying to contact Professor Doble for weeks, and they managed to track him down and sent him a copy of my article and asked him if he would reply. I was delighted, excited that he was going to do that. I was disappointed in the reply, but I was glad that at least he knew this was coming and had a chance to participate.
People can go to the Post website and look up both the original article, your original letter, your piece, and his reply. But he says in part, "You were about to make a considerable investment of time and money. I thought it fair that you be aware of employment conditions as I then perceived them." He also goes on to say he would never have written such a letter today. But you said you were disappointed with his response. What did you hope for?
It was not employment conditions he was concerned about in that first letter. It was whether I would continue my career, use my education. And in fact, I did after that work in the Philadelphia City Planning Commission and the Redevelopment Authority and City Planning Project. And I did use the education that I managed to eke out. And I think it also informed what I wrote in Food as well.
When you look at the whole thing together, what feeling are you left with?
Well, I do wish that I had been bolder, but I'm glad that I had the chance to embolden my daughter and my nieces. And I've loved my career. I've had a wonderful professional life. But I also would have been excited to have the chance to go further in planning.
What would you want people reading your letter today to draw from it? I noted that you got a lot of responses to the letter.
Oh, it's
many,
been
many stories from people telling their own personal stories. Mm-hmm.
It's worthwhile making sure the next generation knows what happened with your generation. You still have to be aware of whatever injustices you participate in or you're affected by. And you still set your own general path and keep on that as best you can.
Phyllis Richmond was a restaurant critic for the Washington Post from 1976 to the year 2000. She responded 52 years later to a letter she received in 1961 from a Harvard professor who cautioned her to consider her family responsibilities before applying to her program. And she was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Phyllis Richmond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Michelle.
Just ahead, many African Americans have had a complicated relationship with the issue of same-sex marriage.
We'd seen the black community being considered more homophobic than other communities, and that became a narrative that was throughout the press.
Now a new film asks if that's really true and what might change that. We'll hear from the director of The New Black. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Among the many explosive issues the Supreme Court is expected to take on this year is the issue of same-sex marriage, whether same-sex couples should have the same benefits as straight ones. But one of the most sensitive aspects of that issue is the element of race. Documentary filmmaker Yoruba Richin takes on both of those issues in a new documentary called The New Black.
LGBT rights is in its revolutionary phase right now. It's frightening for some. It's revolutionary for others. But what does that mean for black people who happen to be LGBT? My quest in black LGBT equality is about black folks rising up. It is my people. I'm a sister in the movement. And that's sister, S-I-S-T-A-H. Let's be clear. This is the unfinished business of black people being free.
The film is on the festival circuit now. It takes a close look at how attitudes about homosexuality among African Americans are evolving, and it focuses on many players in last year's debate about marriage equality in Maryland. And filmmaker Yoruba Richin is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
So tell us about the title. Why The New Black?
Well, I chose that title, which actually came to me pretty early as I was developing the film. You know, sometimes titles can come very late on in the process. But basically, there was an article, a cover in a magazine, in a gay magazine, I believe it was The Advocate, that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, that said, "Is gay the new black?" Posted that on the cover. And it was a real uproar in the LGBT community, in the African-American community, especially in the African-American gay community. And I felt that that title really kind of synthesized how provocative this issue was, both looking at race within the LGBT community and sexuality within the black community.
Well, but also it does intertwine these kind of two ideas. I mean, you said that you started thinking about this shortly after President Obama was first elected in 2008. And in that same election, California voters voted to repeal what had been legal approval of same-sex marriage there. And you also make a point of saying that it is true. It is true that in the sort of initial analysis of those results, that there were a lot of people who blamed or credited, let's say, black voters with that result. So is part of the message here that these two histories are intertwined, or is it asking the question of whether they are?
Well, it's more, I think, asking the question of whether they are. You know, I was recently asked if there are similarities, and I said, you know, there are differences and there are similarities. So what I hope the film does is be able to get at some of that complexity. And I'm not interested as a filmmaker in giving answers necessarily, but in provoking the question and letting the viewer grapple with these questions. And in a lot of ways, you know, this, I started filming this over the last 3 years, and history has changed so much that I've grappled with these issues. And, you know, I think you see the people on both sides also grappling with it in the film.
I want to play two clips from the documentary, and the first is from a woman named Irene Huskins from Maryland. You know, her partner adopted two children. In this clip, she talks about the children asking about marriage.
Marquise had asked, "When are you and Mommy getting married?" And, well, we're working on it. We're working on it. Why can't it just be the way it is for everyone else? Why wouldn't you want my children to have the same rights and benefits and whatever else comes with marriage than yours? Equality never hurt anyone.
But now I want to play a clip from Pastor Derek McCoy. He's been a guest on this program. He has been a very outspoken activist campaigning against the legalization of same-sex marriage in Maryland, and this is his perspective.
The Bible is very clear. Marriage came from Scripture. It's a unique relationship between a man and a woman that God establishes and he defined, and I don't get to redefine. Our deal is not to put a stop on somebody's love. People can choose to live however they want to live. What we're saying is they just don't have the right to redefine marriage for everybody.
One of the reasons I wanted to play those two clips back to back is that you kind of toggle back and forth between the advocates on both sides. Can we just ask you honestly, do you have a personal opinion about this in this debate?
I mean, you know, I think it's comes through in the film. I believe in equality. I'm a social justice person. And so I believe that in marriage equality, for sure, yes. As I said, it's really not about what I feel. I was so interested in exploring and diving deep into this issue. We had seen, you know, as you said, stated in the beginning, African-Americans being blamed or credited. We'd seen the Black community being considered more homophobic than other communities. And that became a narrative that was throughout the press, you know. Yet there was nothing that, and examining what these feelings were, what the evolution was around this issue, and why there is specific, you know, for the Black church especially, and the Black community, why there are specific issues around using civil rights from, you know, the African-American experience to the LGBT experience, why it was especially, you know, shocking for many to see the Black church or Black church leaders take a stance against another person's rights. I just thought it was a very complicated subject.
Well, what did you come up with, though? Because those arguments have already been heard. I mean, we've been hearing this for the last 3 years. What do you think you're telling us that's new? What did you discover at the point of spending time with these people that you think kind of adds to the discussion?
One of the things that I learned over these last few years of doing this film is how the issue of family and this idea of family has a very unique place in the African-American community and experience. And that's really on both sides. Pastor Derek McCoy talks about how we weren't allowed to have family and how as Black people, you know, during slavery, jumping the broom, and how that gives, you know, in his perspective, that sacred unit of family, because of that history, you know, shouldn't be changed or shouldn't be destroyed. And then on the other side, with acceptance with Black LGBT folks, that family is something that we have always taken a refuge in because of racism, because of the experience that we had in the Black community. So for Black LGBT people, that family structure is maybe a bit different than for white LGBT community. So that idea of being sanctioned in terms of your relationship is very, you know, can be very important.
How did you feel at the end of this process? Did you got two groups of people who you make the point in the film really want to be understood by the people mm-hmm. they value most. How right. did you feel at the end of it? Did you feel that kind of sense of understanding, mutuality was getting closer or not?
Well, I think on a broader level, I felt it was getting closer. And that's because of, you know, history was being made during the filming of the documentary, which was incredible. We had, you know, President Obama coming out in support of marriage equality. We had the NAACP, Ben Jealous speaking forcefully. In Maryland in particular, you had vocal support from the Black church. And you felt, even, you know, in the man on the street interviews that I did during the film, you felt an evolution happening. I felt like I was kind of seeing it and witnessing it. So, you know, I think on the broader scale, there is a movement towards equality. Now, I also, you know, emphasize that marriage equality isn't the end-all be-all for the LGBT community. I don't think, and lots of other people don't think, and there's, you know, the fight will still continue for equality. But I think what we've seen in these last few years within America as a whole and within the Black community in particular is a real movement and an evolution on the issue.
Given that you've outed yourself as a person who supports same-sex marriage, I do want to ask you, in the course of reporting this film, did you find yourself having sympathy for the people who oppose it?
There's some very compelling issues that the Black family faces, that the Black community faces. I understand that we, you know, have, because of our, you know, specific arguably more fragile family units, that there may be a tendency to say, you know, well, we already, you know, don't have our fathers in our household, so having this gay marriage thing is only going to open that up or make that worse. And it's not that I agree with that conclusion, but I understand where that comes from, you know, and I understand where it comes from, where the you know, what we fought and died for in the civil rights movement, you know, through slavery and the civil rights movement, that there is a hesitancy and a resistance to other people claiming that and taking that movement. Again, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think civil rights is civil rights. But I understand that our specific history, which often, you know, arguably gets overlooked and denigrated and not, you know, that for another group to come in and make these gains, I see where that, you know, how that tension arises.
Well, one of the things I found compelling about the film for myself is that the interviews with both people where they wanted respect, with people on both sides of the argument who really wanted to be respected for their point of view. I mean, on the anti-marriage equality side, one of the interviews I found compelling were with some of the pastors who were disturbed by the idea that it was just assumed that they weren't acting under their own agency or out of their own convictions, but that they had to have been, you know, paid by rich white people, and sure, how insulting that they found that. You know, sure. And on the other side, the people who were either gay or who supported marriage equality, you know, their argument that people just kind of assumed that they hadn't thought about it carefully, right, or that it really wasn't a matter of deep conviction for them. Also, have the different people in the film had a chance to see it? I would be curious about what their reaction would be, since you filmed each of them kind of doing their own thing separately. But a lot of these people were related. You know, they had a lot of connections. Right. I mean, Maryland is not a large state. You know, right, you can drive around it in the course of a day. And I was wondering whether any of the people who've seen it, who were pictured in the film, have they talked to any of these people on the other side?
Well, we are actually, that's going to be happening. I mean, we literally just finished the film. And so that is something that's going to be happening. And I'm very excited for that conversation to happen between, you know, those different sides, and, you know, especially the folks who were working against the bill. And I just want to say, too, you said the thing about respect and this, you know, I think the way that we've put these rights, and especially marriage equality, up for vote and for a in these propositions or these referendums or these initiatives, that also doesn't necessarily bring out, you know, that conversation and dialogue that helps us move towards a greater understanding. But, you know, that's where we are in terms of our political system. And so that's also why I chose to do this story, because you have these sound bites and you have these, you know, things that you see on the news sort of charting what the polls are. But how do we get to, you know, further conversation? And as you said, it's within our own families sometimes, these differing views and these different conversations. And we show that in the film.
Yoruba Richin is the producer and director of the documentary The New Black. It premiered at the LA Film Festival over the weekend. It will be featured at a number of film festivals coming up this summer. And we caught up with her at our studios at NPR West in Culver City, California. Yoruba, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Finally, you know those movies you pull out time and time again when you're not sure what to watch? Well, our colleagues at Weekends on All Things Considered have been asking filmmakers and actors about the movies they never get tired of watching. Today we hear from actress Paula Patton. She's known for her roles in Precious and Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol, and she tells us about one of her favorites.
Trailer for sale or rent.
Hi, I'm Paula Patton, and I'm an actress, and the movie I've seen a million times is Talladega Nights, directed by Adam McKay, starring Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, Leslie Bibb, Gary Cole, Sacha Baron Cohen, Molly Shannon, the list goes on and on.
It's a hot one here in Talladega.
I first saw Talladega Nights when it came out in theaters, for sure, and laughed my butt off.
Hey, shake and bake, gal! Woo! Shake and bake!
It really spoke to the American dream, and yet it made this great commentary on our culture.
Ricky Bobby, today's big winner. Heck of a win.
Well, Dak, here's the deal. I'm the best there is, plain and simple. I mean, I wake up in the morning, I piss excellence.
I can't tell you how much I use quotes from it in my daily life all the time. Like, if you're not first, you're last.
Always remember, if you ain't first, you're last.
If you ain't first, you're last.
See you when you're,
see you when you're all grown up. I don't say that to my child, but I love it.
Okay, next up is Ricky Bobby. Ricky, is your father here?
No, ma'am.
Talladega Nights is about a young kid whose father leaves him.
But my mama says he's out racing cars, and, well, they've been as weak as anything that moves.
And somehow this kid from nothing, rises to be this great race car driver.
Ricky Bobby with yet another impressive win. He is dominating NASCAR.
And then a French man comes in named Sacha Baron Cohen.
My name is Jean Girard, and I am a racing car driver just like you, except I am from Formula 1.
And he rattles Will Ferrell's cage, and then he suffers a deep failure.
Yep, I'm flying through the air. This is not good.
Ricky!
And somehow he finds his way back up. He finds his strength. And I think the moral of the story is it's okay to be second.
I just went out there and drove and knew that no matter what happened, my boys, my mama, and my lady would love me.
My favorite scene in this movie, it begins with Leslie Bibb's character going,
"Summer's ready, come on, y'all! I've been slaving over this for hours!"
And then Will Ferrell begins to do his prayer, and he goes,
"Dear Lord, baby Jesus, or as our brothers to the south call you, Jesus."
And he goes into a whole baby Jesus thing, and Leslie Bibb's character says, "You know what, he's a man, Jesus was a man." And he goes, "Listen,
I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want."
Then John C. Reilly's like, "No, I like to think of my Jesus in a tuxedo T-shirt.
Because it says, like, I want to be formal, but I'm here to party, too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party."
And it's one of the most perfect scenes because it makes you laugh so much. And I say baby Jesus so much now in my own personal life. Thank you, baby Jesus. I could go on forever. I love that movie.
That was actress Paula Patton telling us about the movie she's seen a million times, Talladega Nights. And that's our program for today. At Tell Me More, though, the conversation never ends. You can check out all of our stories on the web at npr.org/tellmemore. You can also follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook. The handle is @TellMeMoreNPR. And remember, if you missed our barbershop on Friday, you can find the podcast in the iTunes store or at npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.